Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today's Wednesday, February 27th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:33 p.m. Today we have President Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Michicki, Senator Schauer, Senator Keel, and myself, Chair Hughes. Please silence your cell phones, and thanks to those who are assisting us today. We have two items on today's agenda. First, we'll hear a presentation from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission led by Suzanne DiPietro and Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. At the conclusion of her presentation, the committee will then take up a committee substitute for SB 12 by Senator Michicki, walk through the summary of the changes of the bill, and if there's time, go through the revised sectional analysis. At this time, I'd like to welcome Ms. DiPietro to the table. And this presentation was originally scheduled for last Wednesday, but unfortunately we ran out of time, and Ms. DiPietro was kind enough to make time to fly back into town and meet with us, so thank you. She'll be giving the committee a presentation on the statistics regarding sex offense cases, trends for supervision, violators, crime trends, and trends in pretrial outcomes. I give this introduction because I'd like to ask the committee members to please keep your questions and comments focused on the presentation and at how it relates to bills currently in this committee and bills this committee will soon start to consider. We're going to table all philosophical and positional speech making, mine included, so we can get through this presentation. If questions are meant to clarify something that was just said, that is fine. You may ask them. But I'd like to ask that other questions be held until the end of the presentation, and we'll take those up if we have time. Again, I'd like to get through this presentation in a timely manner, so concise questions and thoughtful brevity are the order of the day, please. Ms. DiPietro, welcome to the Senate Judiciary. Please begin your presentation after you state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hughes. My name is Suzanne DiPietro, and I am the director of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Judicial Council, by statute, staffs the Criminal Justice Commission, and so I am here in that capacity as staff to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And I'm just noticing that it looks as though I may have installed last week's version of the PowerPoint on the screen. However, you do have before you the paper version that I tweaked my presentation based on some of the committee members' comments and questions from last week. So we'll proceed, and I'll have you refer maybe to your paper version, and then if the slides are different, I'll try to deal with that as we go. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is information about the processing of sex offense cases. Then I'm actually going to take up trends for supervision violators. And I'm actually going to then talk about crime trends because folks had questions about that last week. And then finally, if we have time, I'm going to talk about trends in pretrial outcomes. So first of all, sex offenses. So I'm going to try to sort of explain how sex offense cases are processed in Alaska, starting with victimization, then reporting to law enforcement. These are the steps. Law enforcement then refers to prosecution. Prosecutors then file charges. The courts then handle the guilt or innocence in the sentencing. And then the Department of Corrections supervises sex offenders who are out on parole. And I'm going to talk about each stage of that processing. I also wanted to let you know that the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission is just completing a report on sex offenses that was commissioned by the legislature. And that is forthcoming. The commission's actually going to be going over that report next week. We hope to get it to you pretty quickly, and I think just about all the information that I'm going to summarize here is from that report. So first, a few caveats about the data. So one of the things that's hard about talking about crime trends and crime rates and victimization is that it's real hard to get accurate reports of how much victimization there is, and this is something the committee discussed last week, and so you're well aware of that. Another problem with respect to sex offenses is that we've never had a study in Alaska that sort of followed sex offenses from sort of victimization to reporting to prosecution to conviction. And we've never had a study that looked at the cases as they went all the way through the system. So what I'm going to try to do is stitch together the information that we do have about each stage in the process. And it's not going to be perfect, but I think it'll give you an idea of orders of magnitude of how these cases move through the system. And of course, as you discussed last week, the existing data are all pretty clear that many who commit Many people who are the victims of sex offenses do not report those victimizations, and many who commit sex offenses are never arrested or prosecuted. And there are many reasons for this, including societal pressure not to report, and also the standard of proof required to get a criminal conviction, which is high. So this is a schematic of how sex offense cases are processed in Alaska. First of all, an incident occurs, and as we just talked about, sometimes that incident's reported to law enforcement by the victim or by somebody else, sometimes not. Then if the incident is reported to law enforcement investigates. Now, sometimes law enforcement can gather enough information to refer it for prosecution. Sometimes they can't. But if it is referred to prosecution, then the prosecutor has to evaluate the strength of the case. Sometimes the prosecutor will move forward and file charges. Sometimes he will not, he or she will not, because of the strength of the case. And then if the prosecutor, though, does file charges, then the court process takes over, and sometimes defendants are convicted. Usually they are convicted of some charge. They are not always convicted of the charges that were originally filed, and sometimes they are acquitted. And sometimes charges are dismissed, so they are not always convicted. But if the defendant is convicted, then they're sentenced. Then they go to the Department of Corrections, and after they serve their sentence, they come out and are supervised on probation or parole. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Any questions?
Senator Sherrill?
Thank you, Senator Hughes. So I know that you don't, you said it's nearly impossible to track everything because of underreporting, et cetera, societal pressures, but the rest of these blue boxes, as we work our way down, I would imagine that since we have those in the system reported to law enforcement, how many are not referred for prosecution, that data
yes. We
do have available and is tracked, correctly?
Yes, and I'm going through the chair, yes, Senator Schauer, and I'm going to go through that. And there is attrition at every stage of the process. That's why I made the boxes smaller going down.
There's one that directed.
So how we get our information about victimization, there's a victimization survey. It's been done twice by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in partnership with the University of Alaska Justice Center. And you may have heard of this. It was reported in the press. But this survey asks victims about what I'll refer to as sexual violence, and that would be what we would think of as the victimization survey does not ask specifically whether a statute was violated. The victimization survey asks questions that are like, has a person ever through threats or force made you, have sex against your will? That's the way the victimization survey is phrased, so that normal people can understand it. It's a phone survey, so people without phones are not surveyed, so that's one potential problem with the data. But anyway, given the caveats with the survey and how the questions are asked, the fact is that 2.9% of the women surveyed said they had experienced sexual violence within the previous year. So that's a question. We say, well, then how many approximately people would that be if we could extrapolate it to the population? So we took a shot at that. I'm not saying this is the most rigorous analysis, but just to get an order of magnitude, that comes out to around 7,136 people you might be able to presume would have been victimized. And I want to just caveat again, so reported experiences, so what the people who answer the survey are saying may not actually be the definition of a crime legally. And also, as I mentioned, some populations are excluded from the survey, for example, people who don't have phones. And also, I believe these were all women in this survey. So that's the idea of the victimization. It's kind of a shocking number. But what happens now to these, what do these victims do? Well, I think the important thing is that victims do not necessarily report to law enforcement. Many victims disclose to someone other than law enforcement. Some do not disclose to anyone. I think the key is that victim responses to sexual violence are varied. One important piece of research, given the information that Ms. Manfreda gave you last week with respect to the relationship of the victim and the attacker, is that the closer the relationship between the victim and the attacker, the less likely the victim will report to police.
Quick question, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
How does that, this is a
experienced sexual violence within the previous year. How does that number correlate over time? So in 10 years, it's not 29%. There's a smaller number because some people are more exposed to sexual violence than others. Have you, is that a part of your data set?
So through the chair, Senator Michiki, the victimization survey was done twice, and it also had questions about how, I think it had lifetime questions. So some of the women, some of the respondents were asked, have you ever experienced sexual violence in your lifetime? And those statistics were much higher. And I don't have them off the top of my head, but the survey is posted online. The responses, rather, to the survey are posted online. I could certainly follow up on that with you.
Thank you.
So, and again, this is just orders of magnitude. I want to caution that, you know, you can't trace that 7,000 number. You can't connect it to the number that I've put on here, the 1,475. But just to give you an idea of orders of magnitude, in 2017, 1,475 felony sex offenses were reported to Alaska law enforcement. So then the question is, what happens if for those victims who do report, or people who do report to law enforcement, what happens to those reports? We have a couple of studies in Alaska on that question, and this chart here shows you the results of the first study. Now, I want to say that this is only the disposition of reports to the Alaska State Troopers, so it wouldn't include municipal law enforcement. This study doesn't. But I think the important, well, there's a couple of important points here. First of all, we've got a 6% that were referred. Let me start over. So there were 37% of these cases that were not, there was no arrest and there was no referral to prosecution. So for those cases, some were closed as unfounded and some were closed by investigation, meaning there just wasn't enough evidence that could be developed to get it to the prosecutor's office. And almost a slightly larger number, 38% were referred and accepted for prosecution. There was a small number referred and declined for prosecution. So that's where the law enforcement sends it over to the prosecutor's office, but the prosecutors let them know that they're not going to move forward with charges. And then there's also a good category here of immediate arrest. That's 19% of offenders were immediately arrested, and those were, you can assume that those were referred and accepted for prosecution. So a pretty good percentage there being referred and accepted for prosecution, but definitely a chunk that don't make it to the prosecutor's office.
We're going to take a brief through these. Okay, we're back on the record. Senator Keel has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. DiPietro, do we have any sense or any sources? Are these proportions roughly similar for municipal police departments? Any reason to think they're different significantly?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't have that data, but that's actually a lack that I have been thinking about, and I do think that we could work with the municipal law enforcement to get some of this information. These studies are a little bit hard to do, and the Justice Center really is to be commended for the work on this study, but I do think, for example, working with Anchorage Police Department, that we probably could develop some similar kind of information. I don't have it for you right now, but I have a little bit on my next slide.
Madam Chair, given how broadly municipal police departments cover so much of the state, I think it would be very valuable. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I have a question because we have on a prior slide over 7,000 women only reporting and experienced sexual violence in the previous year. 1475 reporting is to troopers and would include individuals other than women. Do we have any sense of the number of incidents of all, you know, boys and men included? That 7,136 is very high. That comes out to about 20 a day. And I believe someone told me that it's about 85-90% are victims are women and another 10% men. Do you know anything in that regard? Do you have any information on that?
To the chair, I believe some of that information was covered by Ms. Manfreda last week. I don't know if I'm remembering it exactly. It is, though, I think there is some percentage of men and boys who are in the statistics. I mean, less than 10%, I think, but I'm sorry, I don't recall the number right off the top of my head.
Yeah, just want to point that out because it makes all those numbers go up.
Yes.
For the number of incidents a year. Thank you.
Okay, so here's the next slide is, this is all law enforcement agencies. So again, this isn't exactly the data you would want. But it's helpful. So this is how many arrests were made by all law enforcement agencies in Alaska. 1,460. So I'm going to take you back to the previous slide, looking at with the troopers, that immediate arrest category, that dark purple category. And then I'm going to show you this. So the thing about arresting a sex offender is that when the prosecution starts with an arrest, when the response begins with an arrest, it's very likely to lead to prosecution. So I'm sorry that we don't have completely comparable data, but this does give an idea of how many arrests were made. Well, it doesn't give an idea. It gives the figure of how many arrests were made by all law enforcement agencies during this time period and the percentage of those that led to prosecution, which is quite high. So some perhaps somewhat helpful or hopeful news there on that slide. All right, so then it goes to the prosecutor's office. And as I mentioned before, the prosecutors have their procedure. The Department of Law has its procedure to screen the cases to make sure they're strong enough to move forward. They do that. And they and when it's strong enough to move forward, they file charges with the court. And then the court process unfolds. It's an adversarial process. The case is resolved one way or another, sometimes by a trial, actually not so often by a trial, most usually by a plea agreement or a Rule 11 agreement. So I'm just going to give you two examples of how those charges end up, and this is sometimes surprising to people, so it's kind of interesting. So let's just say we've got the data for all the court cases that were disposed in 2017. So these are all the cases that were completed in 2017. So this would include people who had charges that had been filed years before, but they were closed in 2017. And if the case included an initial charge of first-degree sexual abuse of a minor, that's the most serious type of sexual abuse of a minor. You can see that in almost all of these cases, there was a conviction of some charge. So only 5.3% were dismissed or acquitted. But you can also see that not everyone was convicted of first-degree sexual abuse of a minor. You can see, in fact, that only 23% were convicted of that original charge. Well, why is that? That is because they were convicted of lesser charges. And you can see here on this slide the different categories of other charges that people were convicted of.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. The dismissed or acquitted rate, one in 20, that seems like a pretty good win rate. Would I be out of line to ask if that suggests we're not bringing enough cases, we're not charging enough?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I probably would not be, that would really be a question for the Department of Law, but what I can tell you is that later on I have a slide comparing the dismissal and acquittal rate to sex felonies versus other types of felonies, and the dismissed or acquitted rate for sex felonies is a little bit higher, actually, than for other violent felonies.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would seem like, and it could be a Department of Law question as well, and you may not have the data, but if the case is disposed in 2017, the most serious initial charge, the way I'm reading this, was first-degree sexual abuse of a minor, SAM, but 52% of those, they would be pled down then to SAM 2. Is that how that worked? That seems like a pretty high plead down rate to those, depending on the data available.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, it could be a plea agreement. It could also be that the jury found, if it went to trial, it could be that the jury found the lesser offense but not the more serious offense. All right, and then another example. So here's again, and I'm taking, these are the most serious unclassified charges. In the report that will be coming to you, we have a variety of other charges listed too, but these are just to give you an example. So here's the most serious initial charge was first-degree sexual assault. And you can see there the exact same breakdown of dismissed or acquitted, convicted of other things, and convicted of the original charge, 11%. And you might say, as Senator Keel asked, well, how does that compare to other cases? And I don't know if this is a perfect comparison, but we thought we had that same question, and so we thought, well, let's see if we can compare the dismissals and acquittals in the charge convictions to in sex felony sex offense cases to felony assault cases, because those are pretty serious violent crimes, felony assaults are. I mean, they're different from sex offenses for sure, but we thought that might be a somewhat fair comparison, and so this is the chart that shows you the difference. And you can see that for felony assault case resolutions, well, you can actually see that there is a blank here. One of the boxes is blank. Sorry about that. The acquitted box is quite small. It's smaller for felony assault case resolutions than for felony sex offense case resolutions. But the conviction on any charge is roughly comparable.
Madam Chair.
Senator Keel.
It probably wasn't a fair question to ask you. Do you have a sense of how it compares to other states or jurisdictions?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's a great question. We could research that.
Thank you.
So then I wanted to just talk briefly about after convictions. Virtually all defendants who are convicted of a sex offense receive a sentence of incarceration. Really, the only reason they might not is if they had spent significant amount of time in pretrial detention. Once released from prison, sex offenders are monitored closely by probation officers, and these are felons, for extended periods of time, and the Department of Corrections uses a model called, they refer to as the containment model. I think some of you may have heard some presentations on that. And it involves very close supervision. So the good news is that sex offenders are less likely in Alaska than other felony offenders to be convicted of a new crime after being released from prison. And they are also infrequently convicted of new sex offenses after being released from prison. And I didn't put a bunch of numbers here because we're still working those through for the final report. It's quite encouraging. It's quite encouraging to me anyway. All right. So does anyone have any wrap-up questions on the sex offense case processing, anything that I skipped over or wasn't clear?
Yeah, I have a question that I'll hold for the end that's more general, but Senator Keel.
Thank you. On those last two bullets, just do you have a vague sense of the proportion when you say less likely to commit them a new crime? Half as likely, two-thirds as likely?
That's what we're...
And then the last one as well. I mean, order of magnitude?
Oh, so for sex offenders being less likely than other felony offenders to be convicted of a new crime after being released from prison, it's not half. It's more than half as likely, but it is significantly less likely. And then it always depends how you count it. Being convicted of a new crime, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but part of what the commission is doing right now, what staff is doing, is being sure. We have data from a number of sources, and we're just being super sure that we're comparing apples to apples. So we're working through that through very meticulously with Department of Corrections, and trying to make sure that we can compare to other studies that we have. I should also say that this is a pretty consistent finding nationally as well. So Alaska would not be unique in that, happily. Infrequently convicted of a new sex offense, the percentage is quite low. It's around 1%, 2%, or 3% of sex offenders are convicted of a new sex offense within, we have studies going out 7 and 8 years of being released from prison. So they would still be on probation during this time. Many of them would still be on probation during this time. You know, so that would be probably helpful, a helpful thing to prevent them from committing new sex offenses. But the fact of the matter is to be released for so long and so have so few committing new sex offenses is, you know, really hopeful.
And you don't have data, though, after the probation period ends. You just, that 1-3% is based on that probationary period.
To the chair, some of the people that we have data for would have still been on probation and some would not have still been on probation. The probation periods vary for each offender, and we actually don't have that data point. It'd be great to refine the analysis with that data point, because that is one question. What happens when they go off probation? Does it change?
Senator Reinfeld, did you have a question?
I do. And basically, Walt Monaghan, the former commissioner for Department of Public Safety, said about 1% of offenders get put in jail in Alaska, so for rape. So I just think it's really important that the committee hears you clearly, that you are saying convicted. You're not saying offenses don't occur. You're saying you're convicted. So I personally find it appalling that you're proud that they're not convicted, because the offenses are huge. There was over 1,000, and I pulled up the research that Senator Hughes did, and that 63% nationwide go unreported. So even of the roughly 1,100 that are reported in Alaska, if you go 63% unreported, I mean, just imagine what that is in Alaska. I'm not impressed with a low conviction rate. Just wanted to make sure that the committee's hearing loud and clear. She's talking about convictions, not incidences.
Through the chair, Senator Reinfeld, thank you for that. That's exactly right. And, you know, I'm just giving you a few tidbits of the data here. Certainly in our report, we break it down by rearrests and also by returns to prison for probation violations. So we're going to present to you in the report the full panoply of ways that an offender could come back to prison.
And what I would like to ask, if you could get it to the committee, the boxes that you had that showed getting smaller and smaller, because I leafed through the draft report, and I don't want to get inaccurate information on the record, but it was roughly something like 7,000 plus occurring a year, 1,300, 1,400 reported, and when it actually came all the way down to conviction, it was around 100, 200. It was very low.
To the chair, about 220 people were convicted of a sex offense in 2017.
So perhaps you could kind of, with those boxes, just provide that so we get a better idea how the funnel really narrows, because I think it is a job of this as policymakers. What can we do that might change that, and what tools do the law enforcement and the prosecutors and the judges need? Thank you.
Question.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 7, the 2015 Alaska Victimization Survey, you said some populations were excluded from the survey. We just didn't get into it. Can you tell me the who and the why they were excluded, how that might affect the data?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, if a person didn't have a phone, they were not surveyed. Children were not surveyed. And I believe, I could be wrong about this, maybe my staff will text me if I'm wrong, I do not believe that men were surveyed for the Alaska Victimization Survey.
Senator Schauer?
Just a quick follow-up. The children is defined as what age-wise? Below what age?
Through the chair, below 18. So we wish we had better data. We have pretty good data. It's never perfect. We can always think of
Senator Reinfeld has a comment.
I just in regards to Senator Showers, and thank you, Senator Hughes. Basically, if the mean age is 15, you know, that are raped, I can't imagine why we're not interviewing the mean. I mean, to me, as you know, the data, I have a really tough time with any data that comes out of the commission, but it really bothers me that if the mean age is 15 and you excluded that whole population, that's a serious red flag.
To the chair, Senator Reinfeld, that is, you know, the survey was done by the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault with the University of Alaska Justice Center. And I don't know for sure, but I could imagine difficulties in a phone survey of minors about their experiences with sexual victimization. I would imagine that could be a difficult and maybe even harmful survey to do.
Through the chair.
Senator Reinfeld.
And through the chair, I just think that if that's the age that is being victimized, then it's an appropriate way you know, to get the information. I mean, because we just saw the uniform crime statistic data, mm-hmm. and that's the age that's being targeted. So just want to get that on the record.
Right, and it because of the privacy issues too, there would have to be a way to figure out how that could be done. A small sampling with parental permission, and then that gets kind of tricky. So, Okay, continue, please, in the next section, trends in criminal justice.
Thank you. So now I'm going to talk about probation and parole. So that's at the end of the process when a person who has been, well, usually who has been incarcerated, although not always, comes out, and if they're a felon, if they've been convicted of a felony, they are supervised. What is the purpose of this supervision? Well, the purpose of the supervision is really at its root to watch the person, to help them reintegrate into society and to rehabilitate them. And the court, the judge who presided over the person's sentencing will issue order, conditions of probation. These are things, rules and tasks that the probationer must do while they're out on probation in order to be successful. And the judge is very careful to order things that will help rehabilitate the offender. And then the probation officer's job is to try to help the offender do those things, to encourage. So right now we have a probation supervision system in Alaska where felons are, where the probation officers have tools to encourage and incentivize people out on supervision to complete the tasks that will lead to their rehabilitation. And they also have the ability to sanction them when they do things that are antisocial or illegal. So we have a system right now where probation officers have the tools informally to incentivize good behavior and sanction bad behavior. And then they also have formal tools using the court to sanction illegal or antisocial behavior. So that's the system we have, and the goal is to rehabilitate the person, to guide their reentry into society so that they hopefully do not hurt other people after being released from prison. So that was just a little background. So before the supervision system was changed to provide these tools for incentives and sanctions, formal and informal, the successful probation and parole discharges were lower than they are now. So this chart shows how successful probation and parole discharges have been climbing since the implementation of the new sanctions and incentives. And these are administrative sanctions and incentives, and then those are what we might say are informal. Those are things the probation or parole officer can do, actions they can take in response to the probationer's behavior, and then there are also the probation officer can also do a more formal response through the court system, and those are called petitions to revoke probation. They file a petition with the court, and then the person has due process. The probationer has due process rights to have that petition decided by a judge. Any questions about probation and parole? I don't want to confuse the issue. So successful discharges have been going up. So the system that we have right now is an evidence-based system that relies on the theory that swift, certain, and proportional sanctions are more effective at controlling the behavior of probationers than delayed, uncertain, and disproportionate sanctions. So specifically, we've got, for technical violations, we've got caps on the first three technical violations. And the response is swift. The person can be arrested right away. They serve their time. And then they can come out and try again. And the reason I'm giving you this chart here on page 17 is to show that we can see this is a count of people who have been admitted to DOC on a petition to revoke probation. So that's the court process where the probationer has done something and the officer files a petition with the court. And you can see that people who come in having had one petition to revoke probation, there's a few of those during this time period, But then we notice there's a big drop-off among people who come in for two, with two, and further drop-off with three, and a further drop-off with four. And you look at this chart, and you might almost think that they're learning to stop violating the conditions of their probation. And this is the principle, this is an illustration of the principle, that we deliver swift, certain, and proportional sanctions. It does not have to be a long sanction. It has to be a certain sanction. It has to be quite clear. And before we implemented this system, we found that sanctioning was inconsistent throughout the state. So different probation officers sanctioned more or less certainly, more or less swiftly. And so the new regime provides more continuity and more certainty, so an offender knows for sure that this is, that there's going to be a consequence if they violate a rule, a condition of probation.
Senator Keel.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say that before this system we had different punishments for the same crimes around the state? I mean, am I understanding?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, the commission found that some of the weaknesses of the old system were that probation officers were reacting inconsistently throughout, sanctioning inconsistently throughout the state for similar behavior of probationers, similar bad behavior. So there wasn't that certainty. So, for example, a missed appointment or a dirty drug test might be handled differently by different probation officers for different probationers. And one of the principles, one of the theories behind what we're trying to accomplish is that the punishment should be certain. So people should know when they do something that there's going to be a consequence. And I think we all can intuitively appreciate that in our own lives. Even it's helpful for everyone to know what the rules are. And the other thing that was happening before was that folks were, first of all, about 22% of prison beds were taken up on any given day by supervision violators, and they were spending an average of 109 days on a petition to revoke probation, and most of those were technical violations. Now, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but that's not the case anymore. So part of what we're trying to do is sort of get a sanction, get them in and then out so that they don't clog up too many of the prison beds, but that they connect the consequences to their actions.
Related question?
Senator Keel.
Thank you. Holding editorial comments. The related question, swiftness.
Yeah.
Can you compare the difference between these administrative sanctions in terms of time to get somebody back in to the way it was done before?
So through the chair, Senator Keel, thank you. I think I've not been doing a very good job of explaining this. The administrative sanctions are things that the probation and parole officers, sanctions and incentives, I should say, because the administrative sanction and incentive system includes incentives. So a person can be rewarded for doing pro-social activities like completing treatment or paying restitution or whatever it is. So the administrative sanctions and incentives that were put in place by criminal justice reform are not the kind of sanctions and incentives that send a person to jail. Those are tools, administrative tools, that the probation and parole officers can use to encourage pro-social behavior and discourage antisocial behavior without actually sending the person back to jail. So they can work through those options, or they can choose the formal method of filing a petition to revoke probation with the court. And that is the mechanism where the probationer can be, arrested, remanded to prison for either 3, 5, or 10 days, depending on the first, second, or third technical violation.
Thanks.
Senator Rainbow.
In regards to it, you said that there's swift punishment for revoking. Can you please define what those caps are for revoking a violation? Is it 1 day, 3 day, 5 day? And then I have a follow-up question.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold. So if a person commits breaks a rule that is substantive or commits a new crime, those types of transgressions do not have caps. But if they commit a technical violation, which examples of technical violations would be missing an appointment, perhaps having a dirty, having drugs or alcohol in their system, something like that. The caps on those technical violations, which are not crimes, it's not illegal to miss an appointment, but they broke the rules. So the judge ordered them to go to their appointments. They're not going to their appointment. That they broke the rule, they need to be sanctioned. So for those technical violations, which are the things that are not new crimes, for the first time you do that, the cap is 3 days. For the second time, it's 5 days. For the third time, it's 10 days. And then after that, the judge can impose any sanction that he or she finds appropriate.
Senator Rempel?
Yeah, so that my point was, and we just had a huge testimony from Department of Law how these are not working, you know, the violating of technical. And it could be serious if they're told to stay away from chemicals and then they have chemicals in their system. So I don't think it's fair to just wash this and brush this under the carpet like it's no big deal. It is a big deal, you know, when they have chemicals in their system. And they said this is just not working. It's not swift, and it's not at all. So this is seriously broken. And I also want to go back that I finally had a chance to go back and look at some of the numbers, too. And in Western Alaska, the average age is 13 for sex offenses. The victims' average age is 12. In Anchorage, the average age of Southeast is 15. I could go on and on. Overall, if you look at the population as a whole for everybody, about half of them are under the victims are children, but the average, the most common age is 18. And I just think it's super, super important to get on record that the uniform crime statistics have shown a dramatic increase of crimes since 2014 when Senate Bill 64 that created the Criminal Justice Commission, and then, of course, SB 91. And I hopefully at some point the chair will let me get those on the record, because I think it's very important to get those on the record in this, because convictions and going to jail is totally different than the number of people that with the rampant epidemic of crime in the state of Alaska. And you can massage the data all you want, but I'm going to be looking at the uniform crime stats, because those are the real offenses.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I certainly do agree that it would be good to have a victimization survey of underage victims. Also, if I may, through the chair, Senator Reinbold, would there be some data that you would be looking for that would help you with this issue, with the issue of the petitions to revoke probation? I'm going to give you some data here. It sounds as though maybe that's not what you're looking for. If there are requests, maybe we could talk offline about other information that you might find more useful.
Can I respond?
Why don't you? We're up against
the law. I was just going to say, Department of Law has got me that data, so I'm good.
So here's the average length of stay for probation and parole violations, and we're talking about supervision violators, the ones who aren't successful, or are not yet successful. So I'm showing you this to show that the length of stay is going down, which does not mean that folks are not being sanctioned. It simply means that they're being sanctioned with shorter amounts of time. So the problem with the way that things were stacking up before we implemented the new system is that again, you know, an average of 109 days for a petition to revoke probation because a number of petitions would be stacked up. And then we get adjudicated all at once, and a person would go back for 109 days, just enough to completely destabilize them, take them out of any pro-social activities that they had managed to accomplish. They go back to jail for an extended period of time, and there's just no evidence to suggest that the longer that you're getting any benefit compared to the cost of the longer stays of incarceration. So the other interesting thing about the way the probation system is working now is, you know, I showed you that chart before that successful probation and parole discharges are increasing. What does that mean? Well, you know, that means that you're going to have your low risk offenders mostly succeeding and being discharged. Well, what does that mean? Well, you're going to have your higher risk and your medium risk offenders who probably aren't going to be as successful staying on the caseload. So what have we done? By allowing the low-risk people to succeed and go off the caseloads, we've sort of unclogged, and again, the probation officers were not spending lots of time on the low-risk people, but they were spending some time, and they were still, you know, on their caseloads. So we're hopefully getting rid of the low-risk people who can succeed. We're getting rid of them more off the caseloads, sending them off to hopefully, continue with their rehabilitation, and keeping more of the high and medium-risk people on the caseloads. Those are the ones we really want the probation officers to be spending their time on. The high and the medium risk. And we do not necessarily need for the sanctioning to be super lengthy. We need it to be swift, and we need it to be certain, and we need it to be proportional. So again, these trends are encouraging. I also wanted to show you that in terms of stepping up the sanctioning, so these are graduated sanctions. What does that mean? That means, well, it's just like any time you're trying to change somebody's behavior, you say, well, you do it one time, maybe the sanction isn't going to be so bad, but you do it twice, it's going to increase, and it's going to keep increasing. And so this is just a little chart that shows you the average incarceration in days for petitions to revoke probation since the new regime went into effect, and you can see that the sanctions are stepping up, and that is exactly what we would have hoped and expected to see.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kiel.
Thank you. Ms. DiPietro, I missed something. I'm sure you said it. You may just have to repeat it for me. I thought the first petition was limited to something like 3 days.
3 days.
So we mm-hmm. average days mm-hmm. in for the first one is 16. I've missed mm-hmm. something probably through clear
the,
to everyone else.
No, through the chair, excellent point. So these are all petitions to revoke probation. So these would also include people who have committed non-technical violations, who have longer incarcerations.
Thank you.
Sanctions. So what has been the result of the new system where we use sanctions and incentives, and we use both formal and informal methods of controlling behavior? We have managed to decrease the number of beds taken up by supervision violators. So before the new procedures went into effect, supervision violators were about 20% of beds on a snapshot day on any given day in DOC, and now they're about 14%, at least in FY18, I should say. The latest time for which we have data, they were about 14%. And that's the red slice on this pie chart.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kiel.
Thank you, Ms. DiPietro. Can you give us roughly a percentage of how many? Is this the same number of total folks inside, or?
Through the chair, Senator Kiel, yes. The numbers, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, and I should have looked this up, I'm sorry, but the total number of people on any given day in DOC in 2015 was around 4,900, I think. And then in FY18, it's slightly lower, maybe 4,600 total people. But my staff is going to let me know the numbers, and I'll tell you.
Thank you.
And to that, because the numbers went down, we can't assume by looking at FY18 that there were more sentenced people in, even though the percentage is up, because the overall number went down. So I don't want the public to think mm-hmm. that we've got more convicted criminals in jail. We do not, based on those charts.
Yeah, to the chair, exactly right. These are percentages, not absolute numbers. And I can get you the absolute numbers. So then, based on the discussion last time, I believe Senator Michicki was curious about the long... Ms. Monfreda of Department of Public Safety gave a terrific presentation on the most recent crime statistics, and some of the questions were about historical crime trends. And I don't have a particular point to make about this slide other than it's kind of interesting to look at the 30-year trend. And this would be violent crimes of homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. And these are the rates. So it takes into account the change in the population, so we can compare year to year. And you can just see that the line really jumps around quite a bit. And, of course, we look at this and we are so curious, well, what caused the dip in 1987? What caused the peak in 1985? What caused the dip in 2014? But I think, I'm not here to speculate about that, but I think maybe the takeaway from this slide is just simply that violent crime, unfortunately, in Alaska has been rising slightly. You know, the trend line, even though there's been dips and peaks, the trend line has, unfortunately, been going up for a number of decades.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
And I just might mention that's just including homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. I mean, we're not including drive-by shootings and possessing explosives and arson and some of the other things that I would put into that category. So it's, as we go into the long-term evaluation of some of these crime bills, I think those are some of the issues that we have to not only drag into the accounting of what this trend looks like, but treating them differently in our laws. I think by definition, those are violent crimes, and that's not how we're regarding them today.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, this is definitely a 30,000-foot view. It's a trend view. And then, so then we thought we would take some property crimes. And also, this is all of Alaska. So this is going to be, you know, Anchorage plus everywhere else. So, you know, you have to take that into account. But again, interestingly, on this long-term crime trend for burglary, larceny, theft, and motor vehicle theft, we see, you know, a slight downturn. And, you know, you ask yourself, well, what happened in 1980? And you ask yourself, look at that. We were all the way down in 2011 to a low point in the 30-year period. What happened in 2011? So, you know, again, we can speculate, but I think the takeaway here is, interestingly, that property crime has actually, you know, again, it's been jumping around a bit, but it has been decreasing until lately. And I don't want to, and I certainly am not trying to in any way make a comment on the recent crime statistics. But, again, we're just taking the long view.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am curious, because we just went through the UCR statistics.
Mm-hmm.
This chart is not making any sense to me, and you can perhaps help explain that. If we're including in the 2017 data that was just released, burglary, larceny, theft, motor vehicle, they were reporting somewhere around 17,000, mm-hmm. and the car thefts alone were up around 4,000, mm-hmm. yet this 2017 total on this chart to show a downward trend is 3,539. Mm-hmm. So what am I missing?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, these are rates, not absolute numbers. So this takes into account the change in population. So it's the number of reported crimes known to police divided by the population. And then the rate is per 100,000. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to fairly compare 1976 to 2017 because there were so many fewer people in Alaska in 1976 than in 2017. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
You'd rather see the absolute numbers.
It's coming up, and I got that. It's just the way I look at this chart when we know what's actually happening, and you look at this, and it's very to me, it's misleading because it makes it seem like crime is actually going down, which we know the trend is up. And I got the per capita. I understand. It's just the way I read that. I go, that doesn't.
Well, and through the chair, Senator Schauer, I hope that nobody will think that I am trying to say that the 2017 crime statistics and presented by Ms. Monfrade. I mean, yes. Crime is up. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be misleading at all. Okay, so then real quickly.
Senator Reinbold-Hausen.
Sorry.
And this will be hopefully, I've been waiting for that opportunity. In 2017, murder was 62, rape 1,073, and that's reported, robbery 949, assault 4,236, arson 139, vehicle theft 4,250, burglary 4,153. Larceny, theft, 17,683. Property crime in total, 26,225. Violent crime, 6,320 offenses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Machicki.
The long-term property crime rate trend is very important for us to evaluate. There's obviously a dramatic increase recently. We've been much higher in the past. As a trend, I'd like to understand why. What happened in the late 80s? I know about the recession, but I'd like to understand why and why we've had a steady downward rate until fairly recently. I think it's imperative that we understand that. So I'm very interested in any analysis that we can get on what's happened in crime since the late 70s, what kind of factors were present, you know, socioeconomic, other factors that were present, and how we can get in front of that as a, you know, not just changing our laws, but the other impacts that are causing those trends to change.
Yeah, I just want to remind everyone that I'm going to ask people to hold so we get through the presentation today,
So if you've got a question, please jot it down, and then we'll take it at the end if we have time.
Sorry.
And I just cut myself off because I also had a question, but I just thought we need to keep going.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. So just, again, this is just, again, because there seemed to be interest at last week, and if it's not of interest, we can cruise through. But Anchorage is just about half the population, and so what happens in Anchorage does drive a lot of the statewide statistics. So it's always interesting to try to break things down by community. I wish that I had the Kenai Peninsula in here. That would have been smart. Anyway, so here's a chart that just shows, slight differences in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks. And again, these are those violent crime categories that we're using here. And this is not such a long view. This is only 2003 to 2017. And then here's that same breakdown by community for some of the property crimes that we highlighted in those other charts. It's interesting. A lot of this will have to do with, local police resources and policing strategies, community cohesion and the community's response, social problems like drugs and alcohol, all those things are going to be different. I think we all intuitively know those things are different in different communities. And it just is important to keep, I think it's important to keep in mind that while we definitely want to take a statewide view, that we can't forget that different communities are different. So then the last thing that I wanted to talk about is the pretrial system. And so I know I've been jumping around the criminal justice system quite a bit because I started at the end, which was the probation, which is sort of at the end of the line. And now I'm going to actually circle back around to the very beginning of the line, which is when a person is arrested or charged with a crime. And what happens to those people in the time period when they are still innocent? So the time period before their case is disposed, their court case is disposed. And I refer to that as pretrial, the pretrial period. So what was the situation before? And I should mention that, I won't distract myself. So the Judicial Council did a study with the Criminal Justice Commission in 2015. It was a sample of court case files of people who had been arrested and charged with a crime, and we went through those files and we determined who among those defendants was released on bail. So who was released during the pretrial period and who was detained? And of course we know that the Constitution gives us a right to bail, and we also know that being detained pretrial leads to worse outcomes. So we know from the Judicial Council's data that people who are detained pretrial typically get longer sentences than people who are not detained pretrial. So it's very important. Also, we know from our prior work that Alaska Natives are more likely than Caucasians to be detained pretrial, and that's an extremely robust finding, and it's a finding that is, I believe, quite unfortunate and shocking, but it is quite robust. Some of the study that the Judicial Council did take into account other factors such as the type of charge, factors about the individual's prior criminal history. We were looking for any other factors that could explain why we would make this finding, that Alaska Natives were more likely than Caucasians to be detained pretrial, and we were not able to come up with any legally relevant factors that would explain that finding. We also found that most defendants were given a third-party custodian requirement and or a money bond. Oh, and did I say that only half, I forgot to say the big number, that only about half of all defendants were released during the pretrial period and the rest were retained and were detained. And that is why we saw that, a chunk of the beds in prison on any given day are taken up by pretrial detainees. So the Judicial Council now is saying, is it different now? We've changed the pretrial release we've changed the pretrial system. We've changed the procedures. We've changed some of the laws. Alaska has. And has any of these outcomes changed? And I want to just caution you that the commission and the council are really in the middle of this study. Unfortunately, the changes are so recent. The changes to the bail and the pretrial system are so recent that the people we are studying, not all of them have made it all the way through the system to disposition yet. And so there are a chunk of people in our study who don't even have their cases finished yet. And so that's why I'm not going to give you probably all the information you would like, because it's not right to release the information when there's still a chunk of people that we don't know what's going to happen with them. So I'm going to give you the information that I feel pretty confident will hold up, and you know, we just have to let a little more time go by for these people's cases to be resolved so that we can sort of give you the complete picture. But we certainly have looked, when a person is arrested, they are brought to a prison facility. Some people, if they're charged with misdemeanors, might be released right there and then on the court system's bail schedule. Some people are not eligible for release on the bail schedule, and they get booked into the prison facility, and then they are given an arraignment. They get to see a judge within 24 hours, roughly. Most of them, almost all of them, see a judge within 24 hours. And the question is, when those people see the judge, so not the ones who are released on the bail schedule, we're not so worried about them because they just went, they sort of, you know, I think of them as they didn't really cross the threshold. They were, they might have been brought to the facility and released on the bail schedule, but they never got booked. So we're going to, and we're also studying those people on the bail schedule, but they're not as much interest, I don't think, as the ones who actually get booked. And then the question before the judge is, should the person be released? And if they should be released during the pretrial period, what conditions should be put on them to ensure that they will appear for their court hearings and that they will hopefully not commit another offense while they're on release. So here's the data that we've got. It looks as though around 69% of people are released at that by the judge when they're seen at arraignment, and about 31% are not released. So that is a slight, well, not a slight, it's actually an increase from the prior system.
Madam Chair,
we were going to hold questions, and I know I've got one for that slide too. So okay. Let's just go through, and then we'll come back to Senator Mitzicki. You're almost done.
Okay. So, and when the people are released, what are the conditions put on them by the judge? Well, in 38% of those cases that we studied, we found an alcohol use or possession restriction. We found an electronic monitoring requirement in 24% of the cases. We found some drug or alcohol monitoring or testing requirements in 21%. And all told, about half of all defendants, whether they were released or not, had these conditions put on them by a judge. So the judge is saying, if you are released, these are the things you have to do. You cannot possess or use alcohol. You must have electronic monitoring, and or you must have drug testing or alcohol monitoring. Also new since January of 2018 is the Pretrial Enforcement Division. I'm sorry I used an acronym there, PED. That's the Department of Corrections Pretrial Enforcement Division. And those are officers at the Department of Corrections who can supervise individuals who are released during the pretrial period. And so the judges we found in this study ordered supervision by these officers for about half of the people they arraigned. So heavily using those PED officers, Pretrial Enforcement Division officers. Also, I wanted to let you know that not everyone who's a judge ordered under PED supervision actually managed to be released because the judge may have also ordered some other condition that the person was unable to meet. So, for example, may have ordered a money bond or something like that. So I just want to let you know that although they ordered the supervision for about half of the people they arraigned, not all of them actually made it out and got supervised, although most of them did. So this last slide is one that I think is pretty important, and we're going to have to keep an eye on this. This is not the final word by any means, but it is, I guess I would say, hopefully moving in the right direction. We're looking at, in this slide, rates of release by ethnicity, and we're comparing Caucasian to Alaska Native. And we're finding that in this study, everyone, including people released on a bail schedule, we're finding that the difference between release rates for Alaska Natives and Caucasians is closer. It is not as disparate as it used to be. Now, this is a very rudimentary analysis. We have not done that super rigorous investigation looking where we try to take into account other factors that might be affecting this. But on its face, very simplistically, it does look like as though the disparities that we had documented before we reformed the pretrial system are diminishing. I think this is a very important thing that we need to be looking at and monitoring very closely going forward. And then just this my final slide, just wanted to list the members of the Criminal Justice Commission. They've worked very hard. We have so many meetings. We have lengthy meetings. They do their homework. They prepare. They have studied. They have read the studies. They have analyzed the data. They have contributed to the reports. They have read the reports. And I hope that when you see them, you will thank them for their work for the state of Alaska. And then I can take questions on some of those pretrial slides.
Oh, Senator Michiki.
So let's see how to put this into a question that doesn't have me. What was the word that you pontificating? I don't want to pontificate. But I will tell you that the greatest impact in my community is the folks that are out on pretrial. The ones that continue to reoffend are the ones that are out on pretrial release. And this the graph, as a legislator, I want something that's helpful to me as a legislator on mm-hmm. how to get a hold of that and turn mm-hmm. it around, and nothing here provides yeah. that. I mean, it talks about the percentage of people that are released or not released on mm-hmm. pretrial, but how did it impact mm-hmm. public safety? I would say mm-hmm. fairly negatively, mm-hmm. right? How many of them failed to appear for court? How many of the violations of how many violated conditions of release? There are so many questions that I would have that are not shared here, and I'm not sure what the purpose of the presentation is, but I will tell you that the pretrial outcomes, in my view, my limited view as a legislator that's over an area that has one of the fairly significant upticks on property crimes, mm-hmm. has not made me a big fan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm mm-hmm. it's a very limited presentation. Mm-hmm. I need a lot more information, and now you see why we're feeling so strongly that we took the wrong path. I just don't see the data that helps me understand mm-hmm. that impact.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I really that is of course the question is those exact questions are questions that are in our study, and I thought long and hard about whether I should talk about those preliminary findings in this forum, because it's not fair, because not all the cases have been resolved. So we do have preliminary data on that, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm holding anything back. We've talked about it at the Criminal Justice Working Group. I'm happy to show it to anybody, talk to anyone. It's not that we're withholding it. It's just that I wouldn't want to release a finding on failure to appear rates or new criminal activity rates, and then, 6 months later, when the cases have all worked their way through the system, I have to revise it because it changed. So that's what I worry about. But I mean, I can tell you that, on the failure to appear rate, that seems to have increased a little bit. And again, preliminarily, and I just want to so be very, very clear. Please, this is preliminary. But I understand, I balance my caution against the fact that things are moving and people have questions and they need to know. So I'll share with you what we know so far. On the new criminal charges, that is actually a little bit lower than it was before we changed the law. So my data sounds like it's a little bit inconsistent maybe with your experience. Actually, it does sound inconsistent with your experience. One thing to keep in mind is that before we changed the pretrial system, about 37% of people who were released pretrial, and remember, we were only releasing half, right? So we were releasing a smaller percentage of people. About 37% of those who were released actually had a new criminal arrest in the pretrial period. 37% is not, I don't think, anything that we should be super proud of. I think we can do better. And the question is, are we doing better? And the preliminary, you know, findings. Now, we've got cases that are not yet resolved and people who are out right now, and we're following them to, but they still are what we would say at risk of a new criminal charge, right? Because they are out and their case hasn't been resolved. We have to wait for their case to be resolved. So that number could go up when all the cases are resolved and sort of all the dust settles on the situation. We'll look at it, and maybe that number will be increased. But right now, preliminarily, it is lower than 37%.
Madam Chair, brief follow-up, I promise.
Senator McChicken, fine.
So you just talked about lower charges.
Mm-hmm.
We were sold the change in our criminal justice system with lower charges, less people in prison, more people in pretrial in other states. No one ever made a correlation to lower crime rates. And we were sort of led to believe that there would be lower crime rates. But the lack of reporting and the fact that we have less things that are considered a crime and the fact that law enforcement is so frustrated could have a more direct correlation on lower crime rates or less people being charged than a reduction in crime. And I think that's the disconnect. Mm-hmm. That's the disconnect of this whole issue that we're struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to eliminate that disconnect. Mm-hmm. We need to pull those numbers together. So, Madam Chair, I think, in my view, with what was sold to me from the efforts of the Pew Charitable Trust and others, is really frustrating because we're still using those same data points that is just missing the point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and I do think that Senator Michiki has made an excellent, excellent point. Is our goal to have less people incarcerated, or is it to have less crime? It's to have less crime on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we do. I'm going to check with this side just because they've had a little bit less time. Do you, Senator Schauer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it brief, and it kind of echoes Senator Michiki. When I looked at the numbers, and as we've been digging into all these crime bills that are coming before us, we're getting to a pretty deep dive. And what I think is maybe shocking and a very ironic correlation, as he just mentioned, that when you look at these numbers tick up, where these crime bills and how they were enacted and when, you see those rates go up because we're talking about the numbers. As he mentioned, I think it's important, and you can try to answer this, but I don't think we really have time right now. I'd rather talk offline so we don't slow it down, is look at those numbers, see what happened, and as he said, when you were talking about how less people are being put in, less people are staying longer, but as we're looking at changing some of these laws, going back, and I looked at what was enacted and how we reduced sentencing and other things that would happen, I think the correlation, as I'm looking at it, is what we did to change the laws to reduce some of these sentencing, parole violations, and other things. I don't think it was necessarily correlated to lower crime or to the statistics, and my point I'm making is I think the statistics are showing the correlation of how we changed the law and reduced those things, as opposed to it's actually affecting the crime rates. And I think that's where that's that disconnect. But that's what I would like to see. Well, like I said, well, to go offline is how you would look at the data to go, we lowered sentencing and a whole bunch of things that we changed, and crime went up. And I think they're disconnected. So enough. I'm sorry. It's not really a question. I'll talk offline. Thanks.
Madam Chair, can I just say one
yes.
thing? So I don't know if I'm going to do a very good job explaining this, but the studies and the research that the commission relied on were studies of reducing recidivism among people who have been involved in the criminal justice system. And certainly recidivism among people who've already committed crimes and been through the system is a part of the crime rate, maybe an important part of the crime rate, but it is not the whole. Those two things cannot be completely equated, because people who have been through the criminal justice system would not account for all the reported crime in Alaska. So there would be other people who would also be committing crime, and that would be the crime rate. So does that make sense at all? We need to think it is helpful. Of course, we all bemoan the crime or the rate of crime, but I want to just be sure that we understand that there's recidivism among people who've already been through the system. Those are people that we've touched, that we've tried to reform, we've spent our resources on, and we would like a better outcome from them. And then there's sort of everyone else out there who might be committing crimes. So I don't know if that helps at all, but I do think it's – I don't want to I'm not trying to argue with your point, but I do think it's important to think a little bit more about the different types of criminal activity.
And I'm just going to – I think Senator Keel had a point too, but I want to make the point when we change the laws – and downgraded crimes. You talked earlier about difficulty. You want to make sure you're comparing apples to apples. Mm-hmm. I think that skews things too. So we're still things going. We're seeing the line go up, but we're not even counting what we were before. So the line would even be steeper if we were counting everything the same, possibly. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess as we're looking at those correlations, I would find very valuable to see a similar correlation for those areas where we recently increased penalties on violent crimes and whether violent crimes have gone up or down. I would be interested in seeing correlations to law enforcement effort in terms of number of police on the street and number of prosecutors, as well as cases turned away by prosecutors' offices, and see whether those don't in fact provide us a better explanation. Thank you.
Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. I think it's really important to note, I believe how you defined recidivism is those that were in the system to decrease them re-entering back and returning back into jail. And, you know, there's lots of really interesting ways to stop that. For example, let's not have people go to jail for a felony. And like that would happen in SB 91, first-time conviction. So that of course, they're not going to end up back in jail, but then they're going to go have a heyday and commit crimes, you know, in our city, which is dramatically increased if you look at the numbers. Mm-hmm. Also, you can dismiss cases, so they're not reentering. You know, the people are paying attention, and I understand where you're going with your data, but that's not what the people I know in my district want. They want the offenses and the reduction of offenses. Mm-hmm. And what I really one of the most bothersome things about some of the data, you said, oh, we have no idea, you know, why more natives are held. You said that was a phenomenal, you didn't have any understanding of why this was happening. Well, if you look at the victim-suspect racial relationships, the Alaska Native suspects to the race of victims, 444 were Alaska Native. If you look at the data here, and I'm happy to provide that, but it's only 9 Asian, 51 Black, 75 unknown, 111 White, but 444 Natives. So my point here is there's a lot more suspects. There's also a disproportionate number of Native victims if you look at the data. And I think that you fail to say that every time, and ever since the first time I heard this data presented about 3 years ago about a disproportionate number of Native being held, it to me, you fail to realize the number and the disproportionate number of Native victims. And I feel for the victims across the state, but at some of the villages and some of the smaller communities, there's it's so rampant, and sexual assault, it should be an outrage for every single person in this community. So I'm more about reducing the number of offenses rather than massaging data and trying to stop bad guys from getting into jail.
Through the chair, if I could just clarify a couple of points. I did not say that the absolute number of Alaska Natives being held pretrial was higher than the absolute number of Caucasian people being held. I said that it was disproportionate, so that you are more likely to be held as an Alaska Native, and so that was that finding. But then I also wanted to reassure you that the commission intends to study the recidivism of people who were charged or convicted, no matter whether they had a sentence of incarceration or not. We think that's very important because, as you mentioned, not everyone who is convicted has a sentence of incarceration. We think it's important to pay attention to the ones who do and the ones who don't.
And we're going to close out here. I just want to say it is very intriguing because you mentioned there seemed to be no explanation why the rate of Alaska Natives was higher. But then, voila, the criminal statutes are changed, and it seems to be balancing out, and you're not telling us why that is either. So perhaps you could, there's got to be some explanation. Do we have, prior, did we have judges that were prejudiced, and then now we don't, or what is the reason? So I would like a little further look into that to understand, because that was a pretty substantial change, and no explanation why. And another thing, this for offline, and members can submit other questions to me, is you mentioned that the recidivism rate for sex offenders was lower than for overall other types of offenses. And I'd like to know, were there new programs? What was happening within the system that maybe impacted that? If anyone else has any questions on that regarding this presentation, we could submit them to our office, and we'll send them to our presenter. We thank you very much for being with us today and answering our questions. And while she clears out, we're going to take a quick at ease here. We're back on the record, and we are planning on Friday, this is Wednesday, so Friday, would that be March 1st, to bring up SB 12 and continue our work on it. We have been working on it and a number of changes, but we do have some legal issues that we still need to straighten out. And because of that, we will be canceling public testimony tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock. We will attempt to, I may have to waive the uniform rules to get that done on the floor, or not sure about that, but we will cancel that, and we will take public testimony on Friday after we work on the bills and possible amendments to the bill. So with that, I am going to adjourn the meeting at 3:07 p.m.